Today, April 24th, is a worldwide commemoration of the 1915 Armenian Genocide by the Ottoman Turks, who planned the extermination of the indigenous Armenian people who for 3,000 years had lived in their Near Eastern homeland, which is now Eastern Turkey but is really occupied Western Armenia. Out of nearly 2,000 Armenian villages they conquered, only one is left in Turkey. They decided to kill all the Christians who they considered dirty dogs and infidels, and also killed many Christian Pontic Greeks and Assyrians. In the sky in Brooklyn above WBAI last Wednesday, skywriters were writing the websites of Turkish anti-Armenian hate speech and falsification of history. This year, the Turkish government is spending $200 million on Armenian genocide denial on billboards, newspapers, and online ads. Where did they get this $200 million from? U.S. taxpayers who give $9 million a day in foreign aid to Turkey? Or contributions from all the U.S. military corporations they buy U.S. weapons from? Obama in 2006 said, "The Armenian genocide was a fact supported by overwhelming facts." During the genocide, U.S. Ambassador Morgenthau sent many eyewitnesses' accounts to the U.S. State Department of how Turkish soldiers killed the men first and sent the women, children, and elderly into death marches into the Syrian desert. One eyewitness said, on the deportation march from Harput, the Turks and Kurds took everything from the Armenians, even their underwear. The Armenians had to walk naked under the sun. Many fell dead, their tongues turned to charcoal, and when they reached a fountain, a Turkish policeman stood in front and refused to let them drink. Since Obama became president, he broke his promise to Armenians to acknowledge the Armenian genocide, and even went to a meeting in Turkey about fighting terrorism. But who are the real terrorists? The U.S. government denies the native genocide, and the Turks deny the Armenian genocide. Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams, who does a lot to help Brooklynites, accepted $7,500 from the Turkish government and tourist bureau for a five-day trip last year to sign up a Turkish sister city, Üsküdar, from which he said Brooklyn youth would benefit culturally, educationally, and economically. But Üsküdar, whose former name was Kutari, was the place of violent Turkish assaults in 1955 against Armenians and Greeks who were beaten, raped, and killed by the Turks, who smashed and looted their businesses, terrorized non-Muslims, making it too dangerous to stay, forcing many Armenians to leave, like Vedat Arkun, Aram Arkun's father. How can Brooklyn, that respects diversity, be a sister city to Üsküdar, that tried to violently erase diversity and whose officials currently condemn the Turkish government's bigotry, discrimination, and prejudice? Eric Adams also traveled to Gazi Aintab, the town where during the Armenian genocide my grandmother's family was brutally murdered, their house stolen, and she was abducted as a sex slave in a Turkish harem. In Aintab, many Armenians were clubbed and shot to death by Turks who looted everything. Today, 102-year-old Birgene Salabian, who lives in a nursing home, said, "I saw the Turks with long whips in their hands prodding the starved caravans of Armenians into deportation marches. Children were crying, 'Mama, I cannot walk, I'm hungry.'" Eric Adams said he had a great time in Turkey and wants to promote tourism. Are the tours going to mention how the Armenian College of Aintab was taken over by soldiers with bayonets and many students killed, and the big Armenian church, Surp Azvadazazen, was seized and used as a prison before it converted to a mosque? Armenians want back their stolen property. Personally, I boycott Turkish products like figs and cloves as I think about how the Turks invaded Cyprus and their lack of human rights in Turkey. I think about the millions of Armenians suffering from detrimental health effects of intergenerational trauma. The results of the trauma of the genocide means that anti-Armenian racism took many forms. Traumatized families had a hard time dealing with healing. Many survivors couldn't face the pain and were secretive, avoiding direct communication. Unresolved grief affects many conquered peoples. Maria Yellowhorse, Braveheart, said, "Historical trauma response includes anger, depression, self-destructive behavior, suicidal thoughts, anxiety, low self-esteem, difficulty recognizing and expressing emotions. There is also health-risking sexual behavior." During the Armenian genocide in Dalvor, 12-year-old Bessa Gasparian watched as the Turkish soldiers killed her father, stabbed to death her 2-year-old nephew before killing her pregnant mother. Gasparian said she didn't shed a tear, explaining, "Have you seen a stone cry?" Another survivor wore black every day for the rest of her life. Here in America, the trauma of slavery of Americans is healed with events like the tribute to the ancestors held each June in Coney Island facing the Atlantic Ocean, which was the largest graveyard in the world, where millions of Africans died. Because the community has a lot to deal with, we think about things like gun violence among the youth, the disconnection to spiritual protection, the stress of being unimportant in a society that prices them out of jobs and housing, racist profiling, jailing. Armenians have experienced colonialism and slavery, and I encourage Armenians to connect with the Black Lives Matter movement. For all people who've gone through trauma of genocide, I recommend the book Complex PTSD, From Surviving to Thriving, which acknowledges post-traumatic stress disorder and figures out ways to recover. Shurumur And the opening oud music was by Jivan Kasparian. And now I'd like to do a tribute to the good Turks who rescued Armenians at the risk of their own lives, because many of the Armenians wouldn't survive without help from these good Turks. Some of the rescuers, when they were caught helping Armenians, were shot on their doorstep or on a public square for all to see. Haik Satrakian from Konya gave a good example. He said he found shelter in Taras. We hid in a house. The landlord was a Turk who worked in the military. Every second day, a town crier would pass through the street, calling upon anyone harboring Armenians to turn them in. This Turk knew we hid in a place dug into the ground and did not turn us in. Also, there were many high-up Turkish officials who protested the genocide. Salah Bey, governor of Konya, a vast central Anatolian province, defended the Armenians, saying there was no justification for mass deportations. He was removed from his post, but he had saved thousands of Armenians. Hassan Mazar Bey, governor of Ankara, refused to follow the deportation order, saying, "I am a governor, not a bandit." He was removed. Mustafa Bey, district governor of Malatya, managed to hide several Armenians in his house and was murdered by one of his sons for looking after the infidels. Also, there was many real Turkish heroes of 1915. The mayor of Lice, Hüseyin Nesimi Bey, dared to protect Lice Armenians. But Rahit Bey, a bad Turk, summoned him to a meeting and had his Circassian militant guard intercept and kill Nesimi Bey and throw him into a ditch. We honor these Turks who helped Armenians, and we know that many times people stand up against tyranny. But someone who does not stand up against tyranny and who's not a good leader is Hillary Clinton, who has befriended the dictator of Azerbaijan, Aliyev. Aliyev was responsible for the killings of thousands of Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh. So I'm not going to vote for her. I think it's terrible that she uses the women's movement to get ahead, and people don't know about a lot of the bad things she's done. But when you make up the list, be sure and add her connections to Aliyev. She gets contributions from Azeris and Turks, and she doesn't really seem to care about how they've killed Armenians. I think it's also important to talk about Nagorno-Karabakh. Nagorno-Karabakh, not many people know where it is. I had never heard of it before I went there. It's the Armenian name is Artsakh. It's located in Azerbaijan. It was given to Azerbaijan by Stalin, and it's really Armenian ancient territory. When I was going to the University of California at Berkeley, there was, in the 70s, there was an Armenian Students Association, and we put up an exhibit of genocide photos in the library, and the Turkish consulate called up our library and said we were telling lies and forced the UC library to take it out. So the Students Association put the genocide pictures in Sproul Plaza, you know, pictures of skulls and bones in a field, killed Armenians. And a student came up to me and said, "Why did you make this up? As if, where would we get all these skulls?" And I was so angry, I took all these pictures, made them into a flyer, and put up 1,000 posters in Berkeley. And this was my first act as an activist. And then I started interviewing genocide survivors, and they were mainly these elderly women. And I didn't realize it at the time, but they had all been raped. And, you know, they had were very secretive, and there was many things that they didn't talk about, because in the Armenian community, if you were raped, you couldn't get married, and it was a very shameful thing, especially by a Turk. And, you know, they had to deal with this without having support groups or you know, a community approval, because it was just something you had to repress. And so while I was there in Berkeley, I had met this guy, Monte Melkonian. And in 1988, when the Armenian earthquake happened, I decided I should go to my homeland and help. And when I finally arrived there and was in the youth hostel in the capital, Yerevan, I met Monte again, and it turned out that he was the commander of the self-defense movement in Artsakh. And he asked me to come along and take videos, because the Armenian soldiers didn't have shoes or bullets or food or anything, and they were fighting against Azerbaijan, who was attacking them. And Azerbaijan, like, had, you know, all these supplies from their Baku oil money. And so I went with him to Artsakh. I was in, he took me in a military helicopter, and when I landed, the children came up to me and said, "Are you a girl or a boy?" And I said I was a girl. And then they asked, "Did your parents give you permission to come here?" And then I was living with Monte's soldiers, and I went to the first battle at Kara Dalu, and I realized that I needed to join this freedom struggle. And coming from Berkeley with the peace movement from Vietnam, I never thought of myself being a soldier, but I decided that, you know, this was the first time Armenians got to defend themselves, because during the genocide, the Turks had disarmed them, and, you know, in large cases, and, you know, they weren't able to defend themselves on the deportation marches. And so there I was in this war in Artsakh, and what was happening is that the Azeris, that had all this military weapons, were doing Grad missiles, which is like 40 missiles at a time on the capital. And I went to the military headquarters and met the commander, Arkady Tartavosyan, who was this very gentle, sweet man. And you don't think of, like, the commander of a country to be like that, but he was. And I met this woman, Jana, who was also high up in the liberation forces, and she recognized my spirit because I didn't speak Armenian very well. And I just started realizing that self-defense is so important, because when I was interviewing genocide survivors, and they had just seen so many horrors, and their whole families killed, and the Turks would do things like skin people alive and herd people into churches and burn them alive. And she said that when two Turkish, the survivor, Vartani Sarkissian, said that when these two Turkish boys tried to grab her and rape her and kill her, she had been able to defend herself and pushed one of them into a well, and that kept her going, seeing all the body parts and all the horrors. And so recently it turns out that Aliyev came to a meeting, you know, in the U.S., and when he went back, actually on the plane going back, he ordered the attacks on Artsakh again. And so from April 1st to 5th, there was an invasion of Artsakh by Azeri forces, and they did the same things, beheading people, cutting off people's ears, mutilating people. And, you know, to me, this was very traumatic, because I lost so many friends in the war, and just being in that war was very hard for me. 8 years I spent there, and I saw how fragile it is when you're, I think it was like 150,000 Armenians and, you know, millions of Azeri troops. And recently, the press has just really mislabeled this whole thing. The BBC says it's Muslims against Christians. Al Jazeera said it's like a disputed region, a violent feud. And the LA Times calls it you know, like an ethnic conflict. The New York Times does the same. But it's not an ethnic conflict. It's the indigenous Armenians who are defending their homeland. And even in the New York Times, there was recently another article, and it said that, you know, this conflict started in 1988 when ethnic Armenians voted to secede from Azerbaijan. It doesn't mention that this was our land originally, and Azerbaijan, you know, was just given it, and it wasn't their land. In fact, during the war, you would notice there weren't any Azeri graveyards in Artsakh. It, you know, it was like their ancient things were all Armenian. And the press is not giving a favorable thing to Armenians. This article in the New York Times says the massacres and ethnic cleansings on both sides ensued, but that's really a mislabeling of things. And when, you know, it was amazing how during the war, this is like, I was like there in 91 and 92, 93. I was there for when we liberated Shushi. And Shushi was an Armenian town that had many Armenian schools and cultural things. And the Azeris just came and invaded it, you know, and Armenians had to flee on rooftops while their houses were burning down. And so it's like a big, it's almost like a fortress on a hill. And so the Armenian Liberation Forces, we camped out for days in the forest and had a diversionary attack. And then we got back Shushi, and it was so empowering, because this was like this struggle in Artsakh was the first time since the Armenian genocide that Armenians got to be strong, and the genocide was in their minds, and they were willing to sacrifice everything, you know, for justice and freedom. Whereas the Azeris, you know, a lot of the guys, they didn't care. They didn't want to be there. I was there for many battles. There was the capture of Khojaly, which was the airport, and I was there, and the Azeris, you know, they have such a way of twisting things and turning things into lies. And now they say that this was the Azeri genocide. And it's so so false. It was like we needed the airport. They had, we left the corridor for Azeri civilians to escape, and the Azeri soldiers went in that corridor and started firing at us, so we had to defend ourselves, and some of them died. And they flew in journalists to take pictures and called this the Azeri genocide, which is a total misuse of the word genocide. And this happens, conquerors do this a lot. My friend Seduzo Kambili was telling me about the Boer genocide in South Africa, which is ridiculous. It's like the Boers consider themselves, you know, in danger when they are the ones that came and invaded South Africa and took over the lands and the homes. So you learn a lot about liars and phony things. And I think that now it's important for people to hashtag Artsakh Strong and hashtag Azeri and hold Hillary Clinton accountable for her support of these, you know, dictators who are just killing innocent people. And there, of course, this is connected to an oil pipeline that goes through, you know, Azerbaijan and Georgia and Turkey. And this oil connection, you know, is always there. And the Russians have recently sold $4 billion worth of arms to Azerbaijan, and Israel sold them 1.6 billions of drones and anti-tank missiles. And I know that the Armenians in Artsakh are always under a lot of stress, because in the Martakert, the town that I lived in for 6 years, the Azeris were like just 3 kilometers away. You could see their lights at night. And now, after these attacks, they are becoming more secret and like trying to enter Artsakh from different places, like Hadrut in the south and in the north, and secretly trying to go over the border. And it's a very hard to defend this land. And this is the problem of a lot of indigenous peoples in the world trying to fight bigger powers and not having the people, because you've been through a genocide and you don't have those numbers. So, you know, please write to your congressman and express support for Artsakh, and which is part of Armenia. I just, you know, in the front of the UN, the Azeris were there saying Nagorno-Karabakh is Azerbaijan, but really it's stolen land. So, now we're going to hear from Professor Germaine McCain, who's from Jamaica. You know, Haile Selassie acknowledged the Armenian Genocide and allowed Armenians to be citizens of Ethiopia. And now we're going to hear, he's part of the Armenian Reparations Study Group, and here is his interview. Our special guest is Dr. Germaine O. McAlphin, lecturer in transitional justice and political institutions, associate director, Center for Caribbean Thought, University of West Indies, Mona, Kingston, Jamaica. He specializes in Africana political philosophy and has researched Native American extermination and the Armenian Genocide. He was a member of the Armenian Reparations Study Group. So, Dr. McAlphin, I'd like to ask you, how did you find out about the Armenian Genocide?
As a primary school, or as you'd say, elementary school student in Jamaica, I saw one of my sister's, my older sister's history book, and it spoke about Nagorno-Karabakh and Armenia. And so, from that very early age, I was introduced. It wasn't until later on, during my college years, that I actually realized that a genocide had taken place based on my, you know, based on some of my political science and history courses. That initial introduction 30 years ago to Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh would come full circle in 2005 when I actually was invited to talk about reparations, and specifically for historic injustice such as apartheid, slavery, Native American genocide. That's when I started doing research on the Armenian Genocide. So I'd say over 11 years now, I've been doing some kind of research or participation in the Armenian Genocide research. I think of genocides as extreme nation-building projects. So most times, if you look through history, how were genocides and why were they created? They were created primarily as political strategies to remove one set of groups so that another group could mold the nation state in their own image. Genocides, and the Armenian Genocide specifically, focus on the fact that one group essentially is targeted for extermination to wipe them from the face of history, because ultimately that was the resolve of the perpetrators of genocide. The Armenian Genocide was designed to remove the contribution of Armenians from Turkey and from Asia Minor.
Just today in the sky above the WBAI station, there was Turkish skywriting about their websites that establish lies as truth, and there's billboards in Times Square that are also inflammatory. Why do Turks deny the genocide, and why do they put so much energy into falsifying the facts?
The uniqueness of the Turkish denial is that it continues to occur with such fervency and with such religious zeal, even in the face of enough evidence to confound it. The question of denial is not the same as saying there is no evidence. The question of denial is even in the face of evidence, and that is what I think is unfolding, because we may want to think of genocides in euphemistic ways, the settling of the national question, the building of the Turkish Republic, all those are just masks for the heinous and atrocities, crimes against humanity committed against the Armenians and others, because the reality of it is that if that is the last stage of a genocide, then ultimately, unless that genocide is rectified historically, the genocide really continues. So as I say in my research and in my public engagement about the Armenian genocide, it is not that it happened 100 years ago. It has been happening for 101 years, because every year that passes that it is not acknowledged by the perpetrator group, it continues as a genocide.
That's right. And can you talk about what reparation means to you?
For me, reparation is designed to be any act or series of acts that are geared towards rectifying some historic injustice. It takes many forms. Most times when we hear reparations, we immediately think of someone cutting a check. That is maybe the least of it. You can't talk about reparation without talking about acknowledgement. If I don't acknowledge that I did you something, there is nothing to repair. Now, when we talk about the stages of reparation, we also need to talk about the types. First, within the context of the Armenian genocide, it's not just an acknowledgement. It's not even just a question of that it happened. It is acknowledging it by doing something to rectify it. The return of lands and properties sequestered, the return of many of the things that have been destroyed. And here we're talking about, in the reparation study group, we're talking about in our report, the sequestration and the return of properties, especially those held by the Turkish government. So many persons begin to say, okay, well, we're advocating for this idea that they are to now just go on individual Turkish land. The Turkish government has enough assets and resources that should be the subject of reparations. You have to return properties, but more importantly, you have to memorialize the suffering that people went through. The third dimension that I like to focus on is the fact that part of what makes reparation reparative and focusing on repair is rehumanizing. When you acknowledge that you've done something to me, it rehumanizes me. It remembers me. As in, it puts back in sharp focus the reality that these people that died, they had families. They have families that continue to suffer. And so when we talk about trauma, we are talking about intergenerational trauma. The trauma of slavery continues to exist within those who are descendants of the enslaved, primarily because there has never been a proper rectification historically. So when we talk about genocides and the Armenian genocide, we're talking about a comprehensive approach to dealing with the past. But it has to start with an acknowledgement. If you don't believe you did me something, then what would you be repairing?
Yes, I think the issue of trauma is very important, because intergenerational trauma just goes on and on until there is acknowledgement. You know, my own grandmother was a sex slave in a Turkish harem. And it's interesting that there were Armenian women that were kidnapped and abducted and put into brothels as comfort women, just like Korean women. Some of the Turkish soldiers supplemented their pay by selling Armenian women to surrounding communities. Deportees were sold as auction as sex slaves. In one account, it said soldiers were pushing 300 or 400 naked Armenian girls and women. They were put up for auction and a whole lot of disposed of for 3 or 4 francs. Only Mohammedans were allowed to buy. The salesman kept on exclaiming, "Rejoice, O ye faithful, in the shame of Christians." I noticed that there's not much research done on Armenian slavery. Why do you think that is?
So Most times when we think of slavery, in the imagination, we think only of the transatlantic slave trade, but slavery has been an ignoble institution for millennia. The question any group that suffers the loss of their rights and their humanities has been treated like an enslaved people. They may not think of slaves because even the Caribbean, we are moving away from this nomenclature of calling them slaves. We call them the enslaved because their identity, their primary identity was not slaves. They were first human beings. They were enslaved. So when you look at this, I think part of what needs to happen, as you say, is research on this sexual slavery, because the nice euphemism is comfort women, but it was not comfort that the Armenian women voluntarily offered. They were forced essentially into sexual servitude. So I think rightfully so, more research has to be done on it. But one could speculate that women become primary targets within any genocide. We can look at all these genocides that occurred. Part of genocidal perpetration is to also further dehumanize women by making them the lowest of property, ironically, however, accessing them for sexual gratification.
Well, I think a lot of reason why we don't hear about this is just the shame of it. Armenian women were very modest, and to be paraded naked through Turkish villages, taken as slave brides and put in prostitution, you know, this is, everyone wants to forget about it. I just wanted to ask you, I know that the Caribbeans are interested in reparations. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
The former primarily British territories are demanding and advocating for reparations for slavery. As recent as earlier this month, the Cuban government essentially issued a statement in solidarity with our demands, primarily against Britain, but not only against Britain. The CARICOM region is a 15-member community, and so we are advocating for reparations for slavery, primarily on the basis that if the planters themselves and the planter class, the plantocracy, was compensated for the loss of the enslaved labor, then the descendants of the enslaved should also be compensated. And we can't go beyond that reality, that the reason why we're advocating for compensation is not just that the planters were compensated, it is especially because of it. Because when you enslave labor, you get proceeds that the descendants of the enslaved will never get. And that is why we are championing reparations. It's not because we are envious of the wealth of Europe. We are saying, like Walter Rodney said, that you can't talk about Europe's development without talking about the underdevelopment of Africa and also the enslavement of people of African descent.
I know that the Turks enslaved a lot of children's forced labor also. Do you think that the British and the Turks will ever pay these reparations?
I think that, from my own estimation, I believe at some point in the near future, the world historical moment is going to change, and I think we're going to, I'm hopeful that we're going to reach a critical juncture, continued advocacy and continued agitation, that the Turks will have no option but to acknowledge and to accept their responsibility. Now, the same opposition that greets reparations for slavery is the same opposition I surmise would greet reparations for the Armenian genocide. This idea that I didn't enslave anyone, I didn't kill anyone, so I am essentially immune from such challenges. And that I dismiss very persuasively, because if we can talk about intergenerational transfer of wealth, then responsibility must also be transferred across generations.
Can you tell us what was in the Armenian Genocide Reparations Study report?
I was only one of four persons who worked on the report. Essentially, it's called resolution with justice, that we can't talk about resolution through any other means but through justice. And one of the fundamental underpinnings of justice is reparations for the Armenian genocide. The report makes a comprehensive view of reparations, as I said, focusing on apologies and acknowledgement, commemorations, memorializations, the return of sequestered properties, church properties especially, artifacts, villages, towns, and ultimately to restore the humanity and the dignity of Armenians. In an address last year at Responsibility 2015 in New York, my paper focused on the fact that when we talk about recognition, one can ultimately recognize someone by granting them justice. And if you don't give me justice for my cause, you have not really recognized me as fully human. The Reparation Study Group report deals with this comprehensive notion of reparations. It addresses earlier notions or attempts at reconciliation, dismissing the TARC, the Turkish-Armenian Reconciliation Commission, as essentially a smokescreen almost to remove the reality of reparations and to place reconciliation on a very shaky basis.
Well, I know that the Turks currently control so much of our land. Eastern Turkey is occupied Western Armenia, and they have our sacred Mount Ararat, which is the symbol of Armenia. It's, if you go to Armenia, it's on everything. And as indigenous peoples, we're caretakers of that land. So do the reparations include returning Mount Ararat?
I can't directly speak to the return of Mount Ararat because it wasn't singled out. But what we focus on is that a very concrete step has to be taken towards returning properties and lands and sacred places and location to the descendants of those from whom it was taken. I know that we can work out the reality that reparation is required for dealing with the Armenian genocide. And one shouldn't think that because it hasn't happened as yet, then we should stop advocating for it. Much in the same way I advocate for reparations for slavery, it hasn't happened yet, but I certainly believe that should not stop us from continuing to press forward the demands for reparations for the Armenian genocide.
Yes, it's amazing how an indigenous culture of 3,000 years and just the genocide was 1915 really to 1923, and in those years they just emptied out villages, you know, all those villages of people and took them over, and we Armenians had to go into exile. And I know that you have been to the part of Armenia that is now a republic, the small part that was liberated. Can you just tell us your experiences in Armenia?
I went there in December 2010 to essentially meet with and introduced the idea of the Reparation Study Report that was released in its entirety last March, April, to commemorate the 100th anniversary. I was in Yerevan. I presented at a function at the Erebuni Plaza, and I went around. I went to the Mother of Armenia monument. I went and I had a feel of the place. You know, people wanted to find out why I was there. I was the only black person anywhere in sight. And I think what made it compelling was focusing on historic injustice for a group to which you do not belong, but also to a group to which you belong, because I belong to the human race, and the Armenians are a subset of that group of humanity. I learned and had some more groundedness in terms of the ways in which there's also a distinction and a difference in terms of Armenians who have never left Armenia and those who are the progeny or descendants of Armenians here living in the U.S. and elsewhere. You see clear differences in orientation in terms of the advocacy for reparations and also the understanding of what reparations entails. I think part of what is required is for there to be a practical bridge between Armenians in Armenia who are domesticated in terms of focusing only on the domestic without internationalizing the fact that if reparations are to be successful and if the genocide is to be properly resolved, it will require the partnership of Armenians at home and abroad, as well as from other groups.
And you were also the guest speaker in Glendale at the 100th anniversary. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I had the honor of being the guest speaker, not just at the City of Glendale commemoration. I also spoke at the Martyrs Monument, and I also spoke at the Organization of Istanbul Armenians. This year, I spoke at these events, focusing on the fact that if we are to properly understand what reparations entail, we should focus not just on getting monies, but focusing on getting back the identity. Because as I made the point, much of the Armenian identity over the last 100 years has been unfortunately shaped by the genocide. When your identity is shaped by trauma, it is difficult to come out of the cycle of victimhood. And that's part of the conundrum that we find in terms of reparations for slavery, that when your identity is shaped by a genocide or by a historic injustice, your descendants continue in the cycle of victimhood.
I applaud you for all your wonderful work, and I hope that different cultures that have gone through genocide can learn from each other and join yes. together. And how do you think we can get more people and countries to recognize all these genocides and do something about it?
Public education is important, and you have to start very young. I read a lot, and so I continue to encourage my daughter, and as young as she is, 8 years old, to begin to understand that injustice, wherever it exists, must be dealt with. So I think it's important to do public education, and those who advocate for justice must advocate for justice outside of their immediate group. I am of African descent, happen to be born and raised in the Caribbean, but I must advocate for justice, not just for the African-American and the African cause. And that is the same thing that Armenians must do. You have to broaden your support for historic injustice in order to partner with other groups to build a solidarity that intersects and transcends race and ethnic group. That's the only way we can think about reparations and the likelihood of success of reparations.
And there's a website, teachgenocide.org, that
yes.
Teachers can use, and anyone can go there and get information about different genocides. Where can they get a report of the Armenian Genocide Reparation?
The report is actually online.
Mm-hmm.
So it's armeniangenocidereparations.com. That's the full website. The web link, and you can access the report there. There's also an executive summary, and there are also other translations of the report.
Wonderful. And finally, I'd just like to ask you, how would you compare the Native genocide here to the Armenian genocide, since you've studied both of them?
The comparison is that both of them have not been properly acknowledged. They range in their intensity in terms of over time what it has meant. The modern American Republic was founded on this idea that those people, have been peripheral to the making of the American Republic, when of truth, they have been central. The same analog can be used to describe the Armenians, that they were a peripheral fringe group to Asia Minor and to Turkey and Armenia. But in reality, their contribution supersedes and transcends what has been attributed to them, which isn't a whole lot. And I find that the same thing has occurred even within the American context. We may hear of place names now, but most persons won't know that Massachusetts or Connecticut or Canarsie in New York or many of these places are the names and identities of the peoples who lived there hundreds of years before the American Republic was founded. But what it confirms is that it doesn't matter how long ago a genocide occurred, if it has not been resolved, those people continue to suffer. Those who died, but also their generations that continue to live.
I know here in New York we have Columbus Circle, Columbus Avenue, and to the Native people, Columbus was a mass murderer, and he was so cruel. He was actually sent by his own people back to Spain in chains. And a lot of people don't realize, you know, how the Tainos were affected by him. And in Turkey, there's also a lot of like Talat Pasha avenues and schools. And Talat Pasha was also, you know, a mass murderer. And it's interesting also Atatürk, you know, he is promoted as someone who started Turkish women's rights, and even the book Sisterhood is Global praises him, but he was also responsible for killing a lot of Armenians in Smyrna. And so it's interesting that in both of these countries, the perpetrators are glorified to this day, and nobody knows the truth a lot.
Yeah, and these things occur, and the reality in South Africa, they've been having this question, you know, engaged over the last 20 odd years. Do we rename places that have been associated with the overt and covert racism and racial oppression of the apartheid era? Many universities across the U.S. Have been engaging that in terms of renaming halls of residence and many other places, and some states have renamed schools in certain districts. Being sensitive to the reality that these names are identified with people who are demagogues and bigots, you know, and should not be glorified and live on in perpetuity. The only way that is going to happen within the context of Turkey requires more than just the advocacy and the agitation of Armenians. That will require the world to partner with Armenia to address those issues, because Armenia can't go it alone. It's not a solo fight.
I thank you so much for all this information and what you're talking about. You know, the humanity of truth and justice is so important, because to me, truth is medicine. It has a very healing power. That's what we're searching for. So thank you once again.
You are most welcome. It was my pleasure and my privilege to have shared just a few insights from my own experiences.
Here in New York, if you want more information about the Armenian Genocide, you can go to the Left Forum, which is going to have a workshop on Turkish denial and the question of reparations. Also, the Zorab Center at St. Vartan's Church in Manhattan has a library. There's the New York High Group in Queens and Holy Martyrs School there, which can teach your children a lot. The ANC, the Armenian National Committee of America, and the Armenian Assembly all have good websites. I made a Palestinian Armenian solidarity banner, Sisters in Struggles to Regain Their Occupied Homelands. So I'm calling on all poets and playwrights to mention Armenia when they mention Palestine. And I think that it's wonderful to have free speech radio, and please support WBAI. My name is Anoush Tertalyan, and I also recommend the Armenian USA Armenian Life newspaper. The editor, Apo Jabarian, said, "The liar's seeds have no roots," referring to the Turks. And you can reach me at anoush49@hotmail.com, anoush49@hotmail.com, and I'd love to hear from you. Thank you.
I am